Welcome to the Anarchist News Podcast. This is episode 17 for June 25th. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the previous week. It is designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us feedback and constructive criticism at our email address, podcast@anarchistnews.org. Most stories have more information at the non-sectarian anarchist news site, anarchistnews.org. Editorial on Hodgkinson and Pariahs by a collective member. I was disappointed, though not surprised, to observe the mix of condemnation and silence by many anarchists surrounding the shooting of Republicans by James Hodgkinson. These reactions included a local anarchist book fair page posting the article, "You Can't Blow Up a Social Relationship," one of those ancient texts that gets dragged up every time something mildly interesting happens in an attempt to make everyone feel self-conscious about the brief excitement they were feeling, as well as various lurid articles circulating on Facebook surrounding Hodgkinson's history of domestic abuse. Of course, there was some excitement and more than a few humorous memes floating around taking their own shot at Scalise, but among many anarchists, the whole event seemed to be greeted with either disinterest or disgust. It reminded me of the silence and condemnation that greeted another act of violence against the government, in that case Andrew Joseph Stack flying a plane into an IRS building in 2010. Stack was another pissed off normie. He was angry about his tax problems, the recent government bailouts of corporations and financial institutions, and issues around tax reform that he saw as driving people into poverty. His class status as a white middle-class software consultant, fallen from grace and expressing himself as a libertarian, made many anarchists unsympathetic. While the dust is still settling, it appears that James Hodgkinson is similarly untouchable. As an outspoken supporter of Bernie Sanders, whose anger at the world was expressed in a mix of opposition to the Republican Party and some nasty incidents of domestic violence, it appears that he was hardly part of our team. To some extent, this disinterest is understandable, but I also think that there's something to be said about what we looked for in those who commit extreme actions for a cause. Looking back at the history of antisocial anarchist violence, when people were doing things like blowing up cafes simply because they were frequented by moneyed customers, frequently those martyrs were fighting for ideals that many of us would now consider foolish or futile, trying to wake up the working class or pave the way to a revolutionary utopia that would never come. We hold dear the memories of these people not because they were politically or personally perfect, but because they took extreme actions in an attempt to end the misery of their everyday lives. In this sense, I think it's worth considering the legacies of people like Stack and Hodgkinson with a bit more humility. The most sympathetic responses to Stack's suicide were from people who said something to the effect of, "It's sad that he killed himself. If only we had a strong anarchist movement in the U.S. so he could have joined that instead." In a similar vein, many anarchist criticisms of Hodgkinson's action are more concerned with a perceived lack of strategy than the violence itself. While I can appreciate the concern for the social isolation people like Stack and Hodgkinson faced in their lives, I also fear a political praxis that gives someone a reason to live by offering them a chance to slog away at some service job in the hope that someday they'll be working at a unionized Starbucks instead. The antisocial urge that causes people to violence is the urge to abolish everything that oppresses us now, and as de Kooning states in Theory of Gloom, quote, "For those who haven't yet surrendered to the cybernetic sleep, these individual eruptions, which are bound to multiply, constitute so many calls for desertion and fraternity. The freedom they affirm is not that of a particular human being focused on a specific goal, but that of everyone, that of our kind. A single man suffices to attest that freedom has not vanished." Unclear. What's new this week? Fighting in Brazil, 3 years of revolt, repression, and reaction. This is one of CrimeThink's epic stories, this time about Brazil, what is going on there now, and some of the events leading up to the current ones, including notably the hosting of the Olympics and the World Cup. Quote, "About 800,000 people protested against the Confederations Cup in all of the host cities, including 300,000 in Rio de Janeiro alone, 60,000 in Belo Horizonte, and 100,000 in Fortaleza. These protests highlighted a number of common themes, including the impact of the mega events on the people evicted to make way for the people coming in as tourists, and on those living under military occupation in the favelas, as well as informal workers and street workers who were forced out to open space for the monopoly of the sponsoring companies." Unquote.
Santiago, Chile. Anarchists erect barricades in solidarity with the two murdered Mapuche activists. We got this through Ruptura Colectiva, It was translated by Insurrection News. It's a brief notice about an action on June 14th. Quote, about a dozen hooded ones blocked traffic, distributed leaflets, and raised banners outside the Metropolitan Technological University in solidarity with the Mapuche who were murdered in the South during a land reclamation action. The warriors Luis Murillo and Patricio Gonzalez will be avenged with blood. Unquote.
Posters in solidarity with J20 defendants. This announces three posters in support of the J20 defendants and links for downloading them, as well as instructions on how to make wheat paste.
A response to Beyond Bash the Fash. From IGD, this is an only slightly defensive response to the Quite Good podcast also covered this week. For one example, the podcast discusses the distraction of fascism as both a flashpoint issue and a site of struggle. To which this author responds that anarchists have been fighting fascists for years without the spotlight. Not quite getting the point, in my opinion. But aside from these fairly minor points, this is an appreciative and good faith response, just not quite as interesting as the podcast, at least for this listener. Quote, but to be clear, I think the more central issue and hard question, just as in the post-Occupy moment, is what do we do with the newer people coming into anarchist circles that are coming through Antifa? With Occupy, we face a situation where many of the organizational frameworks of anarchism were used, consensus, assemblies, affinity groups, but often the critique of democracy, capitalism, and white supremacy was watered down or non-existent. Today, many young anti-fascists are open to the tactics, and often symbols of anarchism, but often lack the overall critique of the left. Well, let's give it to them. Unquote. Our thoughts on the podcast are later in this episode.
June 11th, report back from Plain Words. Plain Words is a local Bloomington project. This is a list of events done in solidarity with long-term anarchist prisoners for June 11th, the International Day of Solidarity. Quote, while our efforts this year were modest, they exist within a continuum of action for our imprisoned comrades that manifests every day. We take time on June 11th to remember and act for imprisoned anarchists, but this does not stop when the clock strikes midnight. For us, solidarity is not a one-off event, an act of charity, or something removed from our daily lives. It is an inseparable part of our existence as anarchists, a tension affirmed through action. Solidarity is the word in our mouths, the rock in our hand, and the blood in our veins. The prison walls cannot break us. Unquote.
June 11th, Thessaloniki, Greece. Responsibility claim for placement of incendiary device. This is a brief communique. Quote, lately, the state has carried out various attacks against squats and hangouts in Athens, Thessaloniki, Agrinio, and Larissa. In response to these attacks, during the night of 11th to 12th of June of 2017, we placed an incendiary device in a van belonging to AKTOR Company on Makedonikos Aminis Street in Thessaloniki. We know that this company constructs the enemy's structures, such as the Skouris mine and the Chalkidiki Peninsula that destroys the earth for the benefit of capitalists, or the Thessaloniki Metro intended to support and strengthen the flow of capital. We chose June 11th, International Day of Solidarity with anarchist prisoners facing long sentences, to express our solidarity with all captive comrades worldwide. Unquote.
Greece. Anarchist refugee squats prepared for state onslaught. Folks here will have heard that Greek anarchists have been helping refugees by, among other things, housing them in squats. The Greek government is now threatening to shut down these squats with no plan, or only crappy ones, for where people who are evicted from them should go. Quote, activists have warned that the eviction order against City Plaza marks a major potential escalation of force by the police and local state authorities, which have not been even vaguely reined in by the supposedly progressive Syriza government as they try to break what is seen as a disruptive and shaming movement which has publicly shown up the state's own failings. The anarchist squats have increasingly been a thorn in the side of the European anti-migrant project, which has made cynical deals with Turkey's widely abhorred Erdogan government to shut the borders and to subject the shattered Syrian peoples to brutal camp conditions out of sight and out of mind. Unquote.
A student strike becomes an occupation for 17 years. From the New York Times, this article about the longest-running university occupation, the one in the National Autonomous University of Mexico in Mexico City. Quote, it remains unclear exactly who occupies the building and how many members compose the occupying force. Insular and Mercurial They refused repeated requests for interviews. Were against the mass media, explained one occupier, who declined to give his name, saying it was a policy of the occupation not to grant interviews without consent of the General Assembly. He was standing in what was once the lobby of the auditorium, its walls now covered with insurrectionist stickers, graffiti, posters, and murals. I don't want to be assimilated into the mass media, he said. But what is absolutely clear is that the administration of UNAM, the largest university in Latin America, with more than 230,000 undergraduate and graduate students, lost control of the building nearly 2 decades ago, unquote. This article is worth reading, and not just to laugh at the reporter, although for that reason too. One of the interesting points made is that the Latin American universities don't like calling the cops onto the campus, a tendency similar to Greece, where the resistance to cops on campus is even stronger. Hashtag envy.
Media projects. Lines in Sand. Audio zine from Resonance. Lines in Sand is a collection of articles by Peter Gelderlos, frequently misnamed as Lines in the Sand, which is a very different subtext. It's years old at this point, so pre-Black Lives Matter, Ferguson, social media, identity chaos, etc. But for all that, Gelderlos does a decent job of exploring some of the issues around current understandings of race, including the weakness of white guilt politics, etc. Quote, human agency is a fundamental component of freedom, perhaps the most important one. Therefore, if someone is denied agency in their own struggle because the most legit thing they can do is be an ally to someone else's struggle, it is inevitable that they will exercise their agency in the course of supporting a struggle they view as someone else's. To do so, they will either look for any oppressed person who supports a form of struggle they feel inclined towards and use them as a legitimating facade, or they will try to participate fully and affect the course of a broader campaign or coalition in which they are pretending to be mere allies. Unquote.
Free Radical Radio Audiobooks, ITS Communiques 5, 6, and 7. Free Radical Radio continues on its controversial path, controversial since apparently allowing people to read or hear some words is definitively dangerous for themselves and or others. These three communiques are each read by Dirtroll. This particular thread on A-News also features a new troll star, one who teases Wigless by remixing and presenting actual comments from the transhumanist Wonder Boy. Perhaps this will encourage Gillis to laugh at himself?
Podcasts. The Final Straw Radio, Anti-Pipeline Action Camp in Virginia, and some Basque names that I am going to torture, Eric Heli or Bizarik Squatted Neighborhood in Euskal Area Basque Territory. I'm sure I did that wrong. First, Sean Swain reflects on the shooting of the baseball team and the media spin about it denying that any of us could be Hodgkinson. This one is complete with recordings from the prison authority breaking in on his monologue. The initial interview by Bursts is a bunch of depressing fucking news about multiple pipelines being built in Appalachia. The interviewee is unpretentious and articulate. She's promoting a training camp to help and train and encourage people to work against these pipelines. Reminders that this kind of thing is absolutely in the tradition of land grabs throughout U.S. history. One of the websites mentioned for more information is blueridge.rapidresponse.wordpress.com. The second interview is on a squat area of 24 acres in the Basque country, including old churches, a big farm, and so on. This again is interesting given conversations in the past few weeks about places for anarchists to live and be.
IGD podcast Beyond Bash the Fash. A critical discussion. Length, roughly 90 minutes. This is criticism of some of the main trends in Antifa today, and it's great to hear. Obviously, people hear it better when it comes from folks with cred that they understand. Some really relevant questions were raised, including democracy as part of white supremacy, the loose usage of the word fascism, the retreat of the left from street fights, and larger strategies of the media, i.e. how the media is using anarchists at all. Separating Antifa from anarchist self-defense, Antifa as a franchise like Food Not Bombs, for example, etc. Quote, not wanting to be the militant foot soldiers for liberalism, unquote, and noting the, quote, devolution of this fight into a grudge match between two groups while others look on bemoaning the loss of social peace, unquote. With some of the strengths, they also talk about many concerns that some of us have had about Antifa, including the flattening of conflict into a specific model. For example, anti-racism has been replaced with anti-fascism, identity-based versus behavior-based perspectives, moralism and crisis thinking, media aggrandizement and definition of certain types of struggles, regional differences are acknowledged, and so on. The main two voices being interviewed are articulate and grounded in what they're saying. The bass in Brooklyn gets a big shout-out, as does Courage in the PNW. Thumbs up for this interview. P.S. The intro music of the IGD podcast was perfect for IGD.
Topic of the week for the week, kids. In a follow-up to the topic of dating, this week we're taking a look at anarchist parenting and raising children. Do you have children? Are you open to having children in the future? And or are you more of the no-kids mindset? What brought you to this position? If you don't have or plan to have children, why not? Is it preferable to prepare them for the world or let them experience it directly? What has been your experience of being a parent? Are we living in a generation of parents who want to be friends with their children? What about anarchists or friendly media that you may recommend to other adult caretakers? Ideally, what kind of school would you want to send your children to, or not? Realistically, what are your experiences of having children in school, and thoughts on what anarchists are currently doing? It seems that we are a long ways off from the modern school of Ferrer, Abbott, Berkman, DeClaire, and Goldman, who all played founding roles in creating a school. But perhaps we're missing something. What is it, or what would it take? So this week, to talk about this topic, I have Jessica on the line, and I believe that there's a baby on Jessica's hip because I hear them breathing.
I'm currently nursing.
Ah, excellent. So, I mean, really my question for you, and, you know, isn't to sort of speak to your wide experience with child rearing or being a mom, but is, can you talk a bit about the transition you went through from being without child to maybe thinking you wanted to get pregnant, or did you not want to get pregnant before you did?
Oh, wow. Well, I think I always wanted to have a kid ever since I was young. And I guess this was very intentional. And I joke to my friends now that having a kid these days, it's hard to make mistakes so much since contraception is so accessible. I mean, at least for now. So we really had to plan this and make this severe, like, serious decision that sometimes it's easier to make mistakes and then just go with the flow. But we decided, my partner and I decided to have a kid. I'm in my mid-30s, and it seemed advantageous to do it right after I graduated college. So a week after I graduated, I had my baby. And, it was just part of us wanting to create our own family and to experience intimacy and build a life with each other in this really special way. If that sounds sappy, but kind of was like that.
Do you think that having a child has sort of become part of your anarchist practice? Has it replaced what it is that you were doing before? How does it connect to anarchism for you?
Yeah, so I've thought a lot about this, and I think about it often. I have a kid who just turned one on Tuesday, and much of what goes on in the first year is really mundane stuff. There's ways to kind of put my politics into my personal intimate life, but it's nursing, late nights, being able to be with my partner and being able to be with my baby and not compromise with work, which is maybe part of my anarchist values is to value relationship over work above all. So even though I graduated and could have gone right into a job, I dropped out, which was actually exactly what I wanted. I've tried to connect with anarchist families too, and I have, and it's been exciting, but as in the Bay Area, it's always hard to connect with people who have incredibly busy lives that are also more complicated by having families and more responsibilities too. So in some ways it's kind of alienated me from the anarchist community. In other ways I feel like it's actualized some of my radical values, which is nice.
So a work in progress.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, when we have to go into picking what we're going to do for school and building more of a household and wanting to see who would be part of our family, because the nuclear family, I don't know if that's a very healthy model for what we think would be a good family system for us. So, yeah, there's that too.
Which is another way of saying that child rearing or having a kid for you has meant opening up all the questions about why you're living in the Bay Area, what it is that you want to do in 5 or 10 years, and obviously the answer to those questions are yet to be written because you're only in year one.
Absolutely. So we're trying to figure out, I mean, it's like the hot topic for my partner and I of like, what do we do? Is it feasible for us to stay in the Bay Area? Do we have to run away to some rural place, up north, or out east? And then I think it changes, you know, every other day. I moved out to the Bay Area maybe 9 years ago now, and it was very intentional that I wanted to be here. I wanted to be part of the radical community out here, and I feel like you can't really take a person out of modernity, and like, so if, though, I, you know, people have varied ideas about the rural rustic life and the homeschooling system and living on a farm, which is very romantic, but you mean talk about being alienated from the anarchist community, that can definitely be, that would be a challenge for me and my family too. So, there's logistics and there's also desire, and trying to find how that's all going to work is still up in the air, and we're curious to see how it'll unfold.
And do you feel like the biggest division, at least locally, is just that you're sort of trapped in the mundanity of the mechanics of how weak and feeble children are? Or do you feel like the predominant urban phenomena of being of anarchists having no children is the big division?
I don't know about weak and feeble children. Do you mean like dependent?
Yeah, they're absolutely
how dependent children can be.
One, they're absolutely dependent on you, and you spend time nursing and not, you know.
Yeah, so, you know, I feel like you can adapt. I don't know how much of a, my life is completely altered and changed, you know, my values and what's important, and just the day-to-day life is definitely different for us. But I think that, like, I wish more anarchists were breeding, but of course that doesn't make sense at all for so many people, for so many various reasons, whether it's people who are against reproductive futurism or people who just literally can't imagine having a family, let alone having more than renting one bedroom and working two jobs and hustling as hard as they possibly can and imagining having another person that they'd have to be completely responsible for. I don't know if I answered your question.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my question was giving you a chance to talk shit about the non-children people and how absent they may have become from your life.
I have sympathy because, I mean, I've been that person for, you know, the greater part of 30 years. Not having my own child and being in a pretty childless community myself. So once we had a kid and jumping into it, yes, it did become pretty alienating. And then you look at the everyone in your life who can kind of be there, but also there's not, you know, or my anarchist community and friends don't necessarily aren't catering, not that it's intentional, but they aren't really catering to, you know, a family-oriented, child-friendly community. I mean, there are some things, and I know, like, the book fairs have tried to have more inclusive... Oh, There goes my soda. And that's my kid calling around. Sorry about that. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, I feel like there are efforts, and I don't want to naysay people entirely. I just think that there's, right at this point in time, and I'd be curious to know how, if I'm just in a bubble or if this is just my generation, but I'm kind of surprised how few anarchist parents there are that I know. I mean, I feel like you could say there are more radical parents and parents who have, you know, left ideas, but explicitly anarchist, I don't know as many as I'd like to. And that's, you know, maybe that will change. I think it's a thing that happens when people are in their 30s. They start thinking about families and taking those very intentional choices that are terrifying but also exciting. So, yeah, I know there's a lot of people that are like, I'm never going to have kids, but I don't know. I still get that. I understand.
I mean, obviously, there's other parts of the country that are a lot where there's a lot more kids, a lot more anarchy babies, but mm-hmm. those parts of the country aren't as easy for other reasons, right? I mean, obviously, you know, prior to having a kid, you took great advantage of all the urban possibilities that wouldn't necessarily be possible in Olympia, Washington, or, you know, Greensboro, North Carolina.
Yeah, absolutely. And you were, and like you go to a demo, and or you go out on the streets, and you don't have to worry about jeopardizing somebody's health or the possibility of being stuck. Somebody wants to be interviewed too. Sorry about that. The possibility of you know, you getting separated from your child for legal reasons because you feel like endangered them. I mean, so you have to. There's like things that you like literally can't do. And then there's, you know, a lot of events that don't happen until 8, and you're like, yeah, I like my kid to be in bed right around that time or earlier. And you know, maybe sometimes your friends will come out and help with childcare, and that's an interesting question that we talk a lot about, is like support and people who aren't parents and don't have children but do want to be, like, you know, unofficial aunts and uncles and family members. And I think that's an awesome thing that a lot of our anarchist friends have done and step up with. But we're not going to study group right now because that would be an exhausted baby and parents on our hands. But I think, you know, this is the early years, and we can also create our own. And maybe if more people have kids, which maybe, I don't know if that's going to happen, but I encourage everyone to take a shot at it. They're pretty fun.
I think it's awesome that you're using this opportunity to recruit.
Yeah, well, I would love to have more anarchist friends, so holler at you guys. It's, you know, I would just love to be able to have, like, the modern school structure in, you know, in my neighborhood with my friends, and we all come together and we do, like, a homeschool share, and we take care and raise each other. That would be a beautiful thing, but literally there's just not enough people in the world where, like, we have to look at other, like, educational and childcare models that aren't so organic and independent from public resources.
Well, I would say that this actually tends to be like a generational thing. So, you know, I mean, we both know of some kids that are about 5 years older that are absolutely being raised in anarchist community. And then I know another set of kids that are about 10 years older, you know, that are also more or less getting some connection to anarchist community. So I think that it is possible, but, you know, again, very difficult in the Bay Area because of how expensive and large the place is. And perhaps the zone where the kids were raised, you can almost track how long people have lived in the Bay by where the kids are, you know? So obviously the kids that are 5 years older than you are in that Berkeley-Oakland border.
Your kid is kind of like
Oakland.
Yeah, we can't pass that border at this point. That's like an impossibility for us financially.
Yeah, which
the people
so crazy.
Who are in Berkeley, it sounds crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is, but we're a little late for it, and that's the beast of the Bay, and people are really stuck where they are. Like, we are lucky where we are in West Oakland, and everybody I know who has a place for the most part won't leave where they are. No one wants to be house hunting or renting, you know, looking for other rent because you won't be able to find it. You'll have to move out of the area. So we all kind of feel like a little stuck in our neighborhoods, and I don't know. Yeah, just that goes into the fact that there's so much involved in trying to just exist in this city, and let alone wanting to make a beautiful project out of it too. Which I'm naively hopeful, but I still feel like it's possible. I mean, this is my first year in, and I think it's going to be really exciting as he gets older and we connect with more people.
Thank you very much for having this conversation with me, Jessica.
Oh yeah, thank you for having me.
Weekly Anarchy 101 question and some answers. In this segment, we ask a question from anarchy101.org, which is a user-moderated Q&A site for anarchists to answer questions on anarchist thought and activity. The question this week is, can the state exist without physical violence? The full question is, I just asked this question in reference to contemplations of violence, pacifism, and dystopias. Probably the most direct answer to this question is, of course, if everyone agrees to it. But I think that there may be some thoughts to be expanded on here. The first answer. As one who tries to avoid absolutes, I hesitate to say never, but too long didn't read, no. Has a state ever come into existence without violence? If I think of a state as the typical geopolitical, economic, social network of institutions, participation is not voluntary, at least not for everyone that the said state considers to be its constituents. If it is not voluntary, then compliance, typically with state-defined and state-enforced laws, requires coercion of some sort at some point. That coercion will include violence, unless nonviolent means prove successful all the time, something I doubt has ever happened. I think the rather nebulous area where voluntary association between individuals that know each other becomes an impersonal ideological institution, a nation-state, is directly related to the number of individuals involved and the corresponding diversity of ideas, beliefs, desires, etc. Any population too large for everyone to know everyone else, where there is such a diversity of thought and action, is going to require mechanisms of control. The state and its various components, police, army, government, laws, etc., serve this purpose rather well, while providing an umbrella of false unity and even more false security. Next answer. I think I can answer this question because of an experience I had as a child, one that is not very uncommon, but which in several ways determined how my life would be. When I was in the fifth grade, all of us were given a series of little tests that involved, I think, pattern matching, grammar, a little math, etc. I don't recall knowing what it was about, but the result was that months later, my parents received a letter saying I would be allowed to go to another school over an hour away, where I would be taught humanities, along with about 100 other students from all over the country we lived in, who had been identified by the tests as specially gifted. This school operated something like a magnet program, which meant that children like me, i.e. almost without exception, white or Asian, bookish, and with wealthy and or educated parents, were bused from all around to do relatively more rigorous schooling in what would otherwise have been an underperforming and therefore underfunded school. That school was in a much poorer district than the one I grew up in, and as I would discover, the children who were actually from that district had very different notions of what school was for and very different expectations as to how their lives would go. They all took their classes with beleaguered teachers of their own race, who were constantly yelling at them. Buzzers by the doors of their classrooms allowed these teachers to call security on their own students and have them removed from the classroom. I remember distinctly the sound of those buzzers because they were constantly being pressed. Posters hung on the walls of these classrooms that made promises like, "No student will fail my class," something I had never even considered before. There were metal detectors in the building, which took me some time to realize were not intended as against me at all. There were also police with guns, I remember, who paid me no attention, but were constantly on the alert for these children, whom my new friends obliquely called non-magnets. The point of this is to say that in the classes I was taking, everyone, including me, was a model of docility. I very often took painstaking and obsessive care with my homework, only to forget it on the kitchen table. On such occasions, I would actually weep and this was not at all unusual. This was because we were all being prepared for a specific kind of destiny that included elite schooling and then some position of responsibility and authority in capitalist white society. There was not one of us who had not already decided to submit completely to the kind of discipline that requires. Somewhere in the genealogy of morals, I think, Nietzsche makes this argument that the more rich and powerful a state becomes, the more it can afford to be lenient instead of cruel. I find it completely possible to imagine that as the planetary control of capital expands and deepens, many, many more of us will have lives somewhat like the docile one I have led. That is, many more people, maybe everyone, will learn to police themselves well enough that no violence has to be used against us. There are, you know, countries where the police still do not carry firearms. In Japan, I read that the police will sometimes address drunken disturbances by surrounding and cocooning the perpetrator in soft mattresses. Can the state exist without physical violence? I'm not sure. Certainly, I don't think it ever has. But I know that for me and for many others, it might as well. I also know that, far from making its presence acceptable to me, this fact is pretty weighty and an annoying psychic burden. One comment after that answer was, the cop in our heads, clearly the most prominent one. Your anecdote makes a good point about how a state might exist without explicit violence, and raises questions for me about whether cops could exist inside our heads if the state had not started out with violence as a primary tool. Does it take cop behavior, violence imposed by authority in this case, to create cops in our heads? As always, if you don't like these answers, or if you have your own question to ask, visit anarchy101.org and join the conversation. This podcast is the effort of many people. This week, the podcast was sound edited by Lena Noble, written by Jackie. The editorial was written by a member of the collective. It was narrated by Chisel and a friend. We thank Jessica and Aragorn for their help with the topic of the week. And contact us again at podcast@anarchistnews.org. To learn more, books, pamphlets, and other anarchist material are available at littleblackheart.com. And news and up-to-the-minute commentary are at anarchistnews.org.
You have been banned from the channel.
This is violence now.